an afternoon's amusement, a horse girl with a curious pet. Raygal hissed and dug sharp black claws into her bare shoulder as Danny stretched out a hand for the wine. Wincing, she shifted him to her other shoulder, where he could claw her gown instead of her skin. She was garbed after the Carthene fashion. Zara had warned her that the enthroned would never listen to a Dothraki, so she had taken care to go before them in a flowing green samite with one breast bared, silver sandals on her feet, with a belt of black and white pearls about her waist. For all the help they offered, I could have gone naked. Perhaps I should have. She drank deep. Descendants of the ancient kings and queens of Karth, the Pureborn, commanded the Sybil Guard and their fleet of ornate galleys that rule the straits between the seas. Daenerys Targaryen had wanted that fleet, or part of it, and some of their soldiers as well. She made the traditional sacrifice in the Temple of Memory, offered the traditional bribe to the Keeper of the Long List, sent the traditional persimmon to the opener of the door, and finally received the traditional blue silk slippers summoning her to the Hall of a Thousand Thrones. The Pureborn heard her pleas from the great wooden seats of their ancestors, rising in curved tiers from a marble floor to a high dome ceiling painted with scenes of Karth's vanished glory. The chairs were immense, fantastically carved, bright with goldwork and studded with amber, onyx, lapis, and jade, each one different from the others, and each striving to be the most fabulous. Yet the men who sat in them seemed so listless and world-weary that they might have been asleep. They listened, but they did not hear or care, she thought. They are milkmen indeed. They never meant to help me. They came because they were curious. They came because they were bored, and the dragon on my shoulder interested them more than I did.
"Tell me the words of the Pureborn," prompted Zarozoan Daxus. "Tell me what they said to sadden the queen of my heart."
"They said no. The wine tasted of pomegranates and hot summer days. They said it with great courtesy, to be sure, but under all the lovely words it was still no."
"Did you flatter them?"
"Shamelessly."
"Did you weep?"
"The blood of the dragon does not weep," she said testily. Zaro sighed.
"You ought to have wept."
"The Carthene wept often and easily. It was considered a mark of the civilized man."
"The men we bought, what did they say?"
"Mathis said nothing. Wendello praised the way I spoke. The exquisite refused me with the rest, but he wept afterward."
"Alas, that Carthene should be so faithless."
Zara was not himself of the Pureborn, but he had told her whom to bribe and how much to offer.
"Weep, weep for the treachery of men."
Danny would sooner have wept for her gold. The bribe she tendered to Mathis Malarowan, Wendello Cardith, and Aegon Emerus, the exquisite, might have bought her a ship or hired a score of sellswords. "Suppose I send Ser Jorah to demand the return of my gifts?" she asked.
"Suppose a sorrowful man came to my palace one night and killed you as you slept," said Zara.
The sorrowful men were an ancient sacred guild of assassins, so named because they always whispered, "I am so sorry," to their victims before they killed them. The Carthene were nothing if not polite.
"It is wisely said that it is easier to milk the stone cow of Ferus than to wring gold from the Pureborn."
Danny did not know where Ferus was, but it seemed to her that Karth was full of stone cows. The merchant princes, grown vastly rich off the trade between the seas, were divided into three jealous factions: the Ancient Guild of Spices, the Tourmaline Brotherhood, and the 13, to which Zaru belonged. Each vied with the others for dominance, and all three contended endlessly with the Pureborn. And brooding over all were the warlocks, with their blue lips and dread powers, seldom seen but much feared. She would have been lost without Zaro. The gold that she had squandered to open the doors of the Hall of a Thousand Thrones was largely a product of the merchant's generosity and quick wits. As the rumor of living dragons had spread through the East, ever more seekers had come to learn if the tale was true, and Zarozo and Daxus saw to it that the great and the humble alike offered some token to the mother of dragons. The trickle he'd started soon swelled to a flood. Trader captains brought lace from Myrrh, chests of saffron from Yi Ti, amber and dragon glass out of Ashayi. Merchants offered bags of coin, silversmiths' rings and chains. Pipers piped for her, tumblers tumbled, and jugglers juggled, while dyers draped her in colours she had never known existed. A pair of Jogus Nai presented her with one of their striped zorses, black and white and fierce. A widow brought the dried corpse of her husband, covered with a crust of silvered leaves. Such remnants were believed to have great power, especially if the deceased had been a sorcerer, as this one had. And the Tourmaline Brotherhood pressed on her a crown wrought in the shape of a three-headed dragon. The coils were yellow gold, the wings silver, the heads carved from jade, ivory, and onyx. The crown was the only offering she'd kept. The rest she sold to gather the wealth she had wasted on the Pureborn. Zaro would have sold the crown too. The 13 would see that she had a much finer one, he swore. But Danny forbade it. Viserys sold my mother's crown, and men called him a beggar. I shall keep this one, so men will call me a queen. And so she did, though the weight of it made her neck ache. Yet, even crowned, I'm a beggar still, Danny thought. I have become the most splendid beggar in the world, but a beggar all the same. She hated it, as her brother must have. All those years running from city to city, one step ahead of the usurper's knives, pleading for help from archons and princes and magisters, buying our food with flattery. He must have known how they mocked him. Small wonder he turned so angry and bitter. In the end it had driven him mad. It would do the same for me if I let it. Part of her would have liked nothing more than to lead her people back to Vaes Tolloro and make the dead city bloom. No, that is defeat. I have something Viserys never had. I have the dragons. The dragons are all the difference. She stroked Rhaegal. The green dragon closed his teeth around the meat of her hand and nipped hard. Outside, the great city murmured and thrummed and seethed, all its myriad voices blending into one low sound like the surge of the sea. "Make way, you milkmen, make way for the mother of dragons," Jogo cried. And the Carthene moved aside, though perhaps the oxen had more to do with that than his voice. Through the swaying draperies, Danny caught glimpses of him astride his grey stallion. From time to time he gave one of the oxen a flick with the silver-handled whip she had given him. Aego guarded on her other side, while Ricardo rode behind the procession, watching the faces in the crowd for any sign of danger. Sir Jorah she had left behind today to guard her other dragons. The exile knight had been opposed to this folly from the start. He distrusts everyone, she reflected, and perhaps for good reason. As Danny lifted her goblet to drink, Rhaegal sniffed at the wine and drew his head back, hissing.
"Your dragon has a good nose."
Zaro wiped his lips.
"The wine is ordinary. It is said that across the Jade Sea they make a golden vintage so fine that one sip makes all other wines taste like vinegar. Let us take my pleasure barge and go in search of it, you and I."
"The arbor makes the best wine in the world," Danny declared. Lord Redwine had fought for her father against the usurper, she remembered, one of the few to remain true to the last. Will he fight for me as well? There was no way to be certain after so many years. "Come with me to the arbor, Zaro, and you will have the finest vintages you ever tasted. But we'll need to go in a warship, not a pleasure barge."
"I have no warships. War is bad for trade. Many times I have told you, Zaro Zoandaxis is a man of peace."
"Zaro Zoandaxis is a man of gold," she thought, "and gold will buy me all the ships and swords I need. I have not asked you to take up a sword, only to lend me your ships." He smiled modestly.
Of trading ships I have a few, that is so. Who can say how many, eh? One may be sinking even now in some stormy corner of the summer sea. On the morrow, another will fall afoul of corsairs. The next day, one of my captains may look at the wealth in his hold and think, "Ah, all this should belong to me." Such are the perils of trade. Why, the longer we talk, the fewer ships I am likely to have. I grow poorer by the instant.
Give me ships, and I will make you rich again.
Marry me, bright light, and sail the ship of my heart. I cannot sleep at night for thinking of your beauty.
Danny smiled. Zara's flowery protestations of passion amused her, but his manner was at odds with his words. While Ser Jorah had scarcely been able to keep his eyes from her bare breast when he'd helped her into the palanquin, Zara hardly deigned to notice it, even in these close confines. And she had seen the beautiful boys who surrounded the merchant prince, flitting through his palace halls in wisps of silk. "You speak sweetly, Zara, but under your words I hear another no."
"The Iron Throne you speak of sounds monstrous cold and hard. I cannot bear the thought of jagged barbs cutting your sweet skin."
The jewels in Zara's nose gave him the aspect of some strange, glittery bird. His long, elegant fingers waved dismissal.
"Let this be your kingdom, most exquisite of queens, and let me be your king. I will give you a throne of gold, if you like. When Karth begins to pall, we can journey round Yiti and search for the dreaming city of the poets to sip the wine of wisdom from a dead man's skull."
"I mean to sail to Westeros and drink the wine of vengeance from the skull of the usurper." She scratched Rhaegal under one eye, and his jade-green wings unfolded for a moment, stirring the still air in the palanquin. A single perfect tear ran down the cheek of Zara Zoandaxis.
"Will nothing turn you from this madness?"
"Nothing," she said, wishing she was as certain as she sounded. "If each of the 13 would lend me 10 ships..."
"You would have 130 ships, and no crew to sail them. The justice of your cause means naught to the common men of Karth. Why should my sailors care who sits upon the throne of some kingdom on the edge of the world?"
"I will pay them to care."
"With what coin, sweet star of my heaven?"
"With the gold the seekers bring."
"That you may do," Zara acknowledged, "but so much caring will cost dear. You will need to pay them far more than I do, and all of Karth laughs at my ruinous generosity."
"If the 13 will not aid me, perhaps I should ask the Guild of Spices, or the Tourmaline Brotherhood." Zara gave a languid shrug.
"They will give you nothing but flattery and lies. The Spices are dissemblers and braggarts, and the Brotherhood is full of pirates."
"Then I must heed Pyat Pri and go to the warlocks." The merchant prince sat up sharply.
"Pyat Pri has blue lips, and it is truly said that blue lips speak only lies. Heed the wisdom of one who loves you. Warlocks are bitter creatures who eat dust and drink of shadows. They will give you naught. They have naught to give."
"I would not need to seek sorcerer's help if my friend Zara Zoandaxis would give me what I ask."
"I have given you my home and heart. Do they mean nothing to you? I've given you perfume and pomegranates, tumbling monkeys and spitting snakes, scrolls from Lost Valyria, an idol's head and a serpent's foot. I have given you this palanquin of ebony and gold, and a matched set of bullocks to bear it. One white as ivy and one black as jet, with horns inlaid with jewels."
"Yes," Danny said, "but it was ships and soldiers I wanted."
"Did I not give you an army, sweetest of women? Huh? 1,000 knights, each in shining armor?"
"The armor had been made of silver and gold, the knights of jade and beryl and onyx and tourmaline, of amber and opal and amethyst, each as tall as her little finger. 1,000 lovely knights," she said, but not the sort my enemies need fear. And my bullocks cannot carry me across the water. Why are we stopping? The oxen had slowed notably.
Khaleesi,
Aego called through the drapes as the palanquin jerked to a sudden halt. Danny rolled onto an elbow to lean out. They were on the fringes of the bazaar, the way ahead blocked by a solid wall of people. What are they looking at? Jogo rode back to her.
A fire mage, Khaleesi.
I want to see.
Then you must.
The Dothraki offered a hand down. When she took it, he pulled her up onto his horse and sat her in front of him, where she could see over the heads of the crowd. The fire mage had conjured a ladder in the air, a crackling orange ladder of swirling flame that rose unsupported from the floor of the bazaar, reaching toward the high latticed roof. Most of the spectators, she noticed, were not of the city. She saw sailors off trading ships, merchants come by caravan, dusty men out of the red waste, wandering soldiers, craftsmen, slavers. Jogo slid one hand about her waist and leaned closer.
The milkman shun him, Khaleesi. Do you see the girl in the felt hat? There, behind the fat priest. She is a...
Cutpurse, finished Danny. She was no pampered lady, blind to such things. She had seen cutpurses aplenty in the streets of the free cities during the years she'd spent with her brother, running from the usurper's hired knives. The mage was gesturing, urging the flames higher and higher with broad sweeps of his arms. As the watchers craned their necks upward, the cutpurses squirmed through the press, small blades hidden in their palms. They relieved the prosperous of their coin with one hand while pointing upward with the other. When the fiery ladder stood 40 feet high, the mage leapt forward and began to climb it, scrambling up hand over hand as quick as a monkey. Each rung he touched dissolved behind him, leaving no more than a wisp of silver smoke. When he reached the top, the ladder was gone, and so was he.
"A fine trick," announced Jogo with admiration.
"No trick," a woman said in the common tongue.
Danny had not noticed Quaithe in the crowd, yet there she stood, eyes wet and shiny behind the implacable red lacquer mask. "What mean you, my lady?"
"Half a year gone, that man could scarcely wake fire from dragon glass. He had some small skill with powders and wildfire, sufficient to entrance a crowd while his cutpurses did their work. He could walk across hot coals and make burning roses bloom in the air, but he could no more aspire to climb the fiery ladder than a common fisherman could hope to catch a kraken in his nets."
Danny looked uneasily at where the ladder had stood. Even the smoke was gone now, and the crowd was breaking up, each man going about his business. In a moment more than a few would find their purses flat and empty. "And now?"
"And now his powers grow, Khaleesi, and you are the cause of it."
"Me?" she laughed. "How could that be?" The woman stepped closer and laid two fingers on Danny's wrist.
"You are the mother of dragons, are you not?"
"She is, and no spawn of shadows may touch her."
Jogo brushed Quaithe's fingers away with the handle of his whip. The woman took a step backward.
"You must leave this city soon, Daenerys Targaryen, or you will never be permitted to leave it at all."
Danny's wrist still tingled where Quaithe had touched her. "Where would you have me go?" she asked.
"To the north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow."
"A Shai," Danny thought. "She would have me go to a Shai." "Will the Shai give me an army?" she demanded. "Will there be gold for me in a Shai? Will there be ships? What is there in a Shai that I will not find in Karth?"
"Truth,"
said the woman in the mask, and bowing, she faded back into the crowd. Ricaro snorted contempt through his drooping black mustachios.
"Khaleesi, better man should swallow scorpions than trust in the spawn of shadows who dare not show their face beneath the sun. It is known."
"It is known," Aego agreed. Zarozo and Daxus had watched the whole exchange from his cushions. When Danae climbed back into the palanquin beside him, he said,
"Your savages are wiser than they know. Such truths as the Ashai Horde are not like to make you smile."
Then he pressed another cup of wine on her and spoke of love and lust and other trifles all the way back to his manse. In the quiet of her chambers, Danae stripped off her finery and donned a loose robe of purple silk. Her dragons were hungry, so she chopped up a snake and charred the pieces over a brazier. They are growing, she realized, as she watched them snap and squabble over the blackened flesh. They must weigh twice what they had in Vaes Taloro. Even so, it would be years before they were large enough to take to war, and they must be trained as well, or they will lay my kingdom waste. For all her Targaryen blood, Danny had not the least idea of how to train a dragon. Sir Jorah Mormont came to her as the sun was going down.
The Pureborn refused you?
As you said they would. Come sit, give me your counsel. Danny drew him down to the cushions beside her, and Jiqui brought them a bowl of purple olives and onions drowned in wine.
You will get no help in this city, Khaleesi. Sir Jorah took an onion between thumb and forefinger. Each day I'm more convinced of that than the day before. The Pureborn see no farther than the walls of Karth. And Zaru,
he asked me to marry him again.
Yes, and I know why.
When the knight frowned, his heavy black brows joined together above his deep-set eyes. He dreams of me day and night, she laughed.
Forgive me, my queen, but it is your dragons he dreams of.
Zaru assures me that in Karth, man and woman each retain their own property after they are wed. The dragons are mine. She smiled as Drogon came hopping and flapping across the marble floor to crawl up on the cushions beside her.
He tells it true, as far as it goes, but there's one thing he failed to mention. The Karthian have a curious wedding custom, my queen. On the day of their union, a wife may ask a token of love from her husband. Whatsoever she desires of his worldly goods he must grant, and he may ask the same of her. One thing only may be asked, but whatever is named may not be denied.
One thing, she repeated, and it may not be denied?
With one dragon, Zaro Zerndaxus would rule the city, but one ship will further our cause but little.
Danny nibbled at an onion and reflected ruefully on the faithlessness of men. We passed through the bazaar on our way back from the Hall of 1,000 Thrones, she told Sir Jorah. Quaithe was there. She told him of the fire mage and the fiery ladder, and what the woman in the red mask had told her.
I would be glad to leave the city, if truth be told, the knight said when she was done. But not for Ashai.
Where then?
East, he said.
I'm half a world away from my kingdom even here. If I go any farther east, I may never find my way home to Westeros.
If you go west, you risk your life.
House Targaryen has friends in the free cities, she reminded him. Truer friends than Zaro or the Pureborn.
If you mean Illyrio Mopatis, I wonder. For sufficient gold, Illyrio would sell you as quickly as he would a slave.
My brother and I were guests in Illyrio's manse for half a year. If he meant to sell us, he could have done it then.
He did sell you, Sir Jorah said, to Khal Drogo.
Danny flushed. He had the truth of it, but she did not like the sharpness with which he put it. Illyrio protected us from the usurper's knives, and he believed in my brother's cause.
Illyrio believes in no cause but Illyrio. Gluttons are greedy men, as a rule, and magisters are devious. Illyrio Mopatis is both. What do you truly know of him?
I know that he gave me my dragon eggs.
He snorted. If he'd known they were like to hatch, he would have sat on them himself.
That made her smile despite herself. Oh, I have no doubt of that, sir. I know Illyrio better than you think. I was a child when I left his manse in Pentos to wed my sun and stars, but I was neither deaf nor blind, and I am no child now.
Even if Illyrio is the friend you think him, the knight said stubbornly, he is not powerful enough to enthrone you by himself. No more than he could your brother.
He is rich, she said, Not so rich as Zaro, perhaps, but rich enough to hire ships for me, and men as well.
Sellswords have their uses, Ser Jorah admitted, but you will not win your father's throne with sweepings from the free cities. Nothing knits a broken realm together so quick as an invading army on its soil.
I am the rightful queen, Danny protested.
You are a stranger who means to land on their shores with an army of outlanders who cannot even speak the common tongue. The lords of Westeros do not know you and have every reason to fear and mistrust you. You must win them over before you sail, a few at least.
And how am I to do that if I go east as you counsel?
He ate an olive and spit out the pip into his palm. I do not know, Your Grace, he admitted, but I do know that the longer you remain in one place, the easier it will be for your enemies to find you. The name Targaryen still frightens them, so much so that they sent a man to murder you when they heard you were with child. What will they do when they learn of your dragons?
Drogon was curled up beneath her arm, as hot as a stone that has soaked all day in the blazing sun. Rhaegal and Viserion were fighting over a scrap of meat, buffeting each other with their wings as smoke hissed from their nostrils. My furious children, she thought, they must not come to harm. The comet led me to Carth for a reason. I had hoped to find my army here, but it seems that will not be. What else remains, I asked myself. I am afraid, she realized, but I must be brave. Come the morrow, you must go to Pyat Pree.
The Princess in the Tower. Hers was a gentle prison. Arianne took solace from that. Why would her father go to such great pains to provide for her comfort in captivity if he had marked her for a traitor's death? He cannot mean to kill me, she told herself 100 times. He does not have it in him to be so cruel. I am his blood and seed, his heir, his only daughter. If need be, she would throw herself beneath the wheels of his chair, admit her fault, and beg him for his pardon. And she would weep. When he saw tears rolling down her face, he would forgive her. She was less certain whether she would forgive herself. Aerio, she had pleaded with her captor during the long, dry ride from the Green Blood back to Sunspear. I never wanted the girl to come to harm. You must believe me. Hotar made no reply except to grunt. Arianne could feel his anger. Darkstar had escaped him, the most dangerous of all her little group of plotters. He had outraced all his pursuers and vanished into the deep desert with blood upon his blade. You know me, Captain, Arianne had said, as the leagues rolled past. You have known me since I was little. You always kept me safe as you kept my Lady Mother safe when you came with her from Great Norvos to be her shield in a strange land. I need you now. I need your help. I never meant... What you meant does not matter, little princess, Aerio Hotar said. Only what you did. His countenance was stony. I'm sorry. It is for my prince to command, for Hotar to obey. Arianne expected to be brought before her father's high seat beneath the dome of leaded glass in the Tower of the Sun. Instead, Hotar delivered her to the Spear Tower and the custody of her father's Seneschal, Ricasso, and Sir Manfrey Martell, the Castellan. Princess, Ricasso said, you will forgive an old blind man if he does not make the climb with you. These legs are not equal to so many steps. A chamber has been prepared for you. Sir Manfrey shall escort you there to await the prince's pleasure. The prince's displeasure, you mean. Will my friends be confined here as well? Arianne had been parted from Garin, Dre, and the others after capture, and Hotar had refused to say what would be done with them. That is for the prince to decide, was all the captain had to say upon the subject. Sir Manfrey proved a bit more forthcoming. They were taken to the Planky Town and will be conveyed by ship to Gaston Grey until such time as Prince Doran decides their fate. Gaston Grey was a crumbling old castle perched on a rock in the Sea of Dawn, a drear and dreadful prison where the vilest of criminals were sent to rot and die. Does my father mean to kill them? Arianne could not believe it. All they did for love for me. If my father must have blood, it should be mine. As you say, princess. I want to speak with him. He thought you might. Sir Manfrey took her arm and marched her up the steps, up and up until her breath grew short. The spear tower stood 100.5 feet high, and her cell was nearly at the top. Ariane eyed every door they passed, wondering if one of the sand snakes might be locked within. When her own door had been closed and barred, Ariane explored her new home. Her cell was large and airy and did not lack for comforts. There were mirrorish carpets on the floor, red wine to drink, books to read. In one corner stood an ornate Saivas table, with pieces carved of ivory and onyx, though she had no one to play with even if she had been so inclined. She had a feather bed to sleep in and a privy with a marble seat, sweetened by a basketful of herbs. This high up, the views were splendid. One window opened to the east, so she could watch the sun rise above the sea. The other allowed her to look down upon the Tower of the Sun and the winding walls and threefold gate beyond. The exploration took less time than it would have taken her to lace a pair of sandals, but at least it served to keep the tears at bay for a time. Ariane found a basin and a flagon of cool water and washed her hands and face, but no amount of scrubbing could cleanse her of her grief. Aris, she thought, my white knight. Tears filled her eyes, and suddenly she was weeping, her whole body racked by sobs. She remembered how Hota's heavy axe had cleaved through his flesh and bone, the way his head had gone spinning through the air. Why did you do it? Why throw your life away? I never told you to. I never wanted that. I only wanted. I wanted. I wanted. That night she cried herself to sleep, for the first time, if not the last. Even in her dreams she found no peace. She dreamt of Aris Oakheart caressing her, smiling at her, telling her that he loved her. But all the while the quarrels were in him and his wounds were weeping, turning his whites to red. Part of her knew it was a nightmare, even as she dreamt it. Come morning, all of this will vanish, the princess told herself. But when morning came, she was still in her cell. Sir Aris was still dead, and Myrcella. I never wanted that, never. I meant the girl no harm. All I wanted was for her to be a queen, if we had not been betrayed. Someone told, Hota had said. The memory still made her angry. Ariane clung to that, feeding the flame within her heart. Anger was better than tears, better than grief, better than guilt. Someone told, someone she had trusted. Aris Oakheart had died because of that, slain by the traitor's whisper as much as by the captain's axe. The blood that had streamed down Myrcella's face, that was the betrayer's work as well. Someone told, someone she had loved, that was the cruelest cut of all. She found a cedar chest full of her clothes at the foot of her bed, so she stripped out of the travel-stained garb she had slept in and donned the most revealing garments she could find, wisps of silk that covered everything and hid nothing. Prince Doran might treat her like a child, but she refused to dress like one. She knew such garb would discomfort her father when he came to chastise her for making off with Myrcella. She counted on it. If I must crawl and weep, let him be uncomfortable as well. She expected him that day, but when the door finally opened, it proved to be only the servants with her midday meal. When might I see my father? She asked, but none of them would answer. The kid had been roasted with lemon and honey. With it were grape leaves, stuffed with a mélange of raisins, onions, mushrooms, and fiery dragon peppers. I am not hungry, Ariane said. Her friends would be eating ship's biscuits and salt beef on their way to Gaston Grey. Take this away and bring me Prince Doran. But they left the food, and her father did not come. After a while, hunger weakened her resolve, so she sat and ate. Once the food was gone, there was nothing else for Ariane to do. She paced around her tower, twice and thrice and three times thrice. She sat beside the Saivas table and idly moved an elephant. She curled up in the window seat and tried to read a book, until the words became a blur, and she realized that she was crying again. Aris, my sweet, my white knight, why did you do it? You should have yielded. I tried to tell you, but the words caught in my mouth. You gallant fool, I never meant for you to die or for Miss Sella. Oh, gods be good, that little girl. Finally, she crawled back onto the feather bed. The world had grown dark, and there was little she could do but sleep. Someone told, she thought, someone told. Garin Drey and Spotted Silver were friends of her girlhood, as dear to her as her cousin Tyene. She could not believe they would inform on her. But that left only Darkstar, and if he was the betrayer, why had he turned his sword on poor Myrcella? He wanted to kill her instead of crowning her. He said as much at Shandystone. He said that was how I'd get the war I wanted. But it made no sense for Dane to be the traitor. If Sir Geralt had been the worm in the apple, why would he have turned his sword upon Myrcella? Someone told. Could it have been Sir Aris? Had the White Knight's guilt won out over his lust? Had he loved Myrcella more than her, and betrayed his new princess to atone for his betrayal of the old? Was he so ashamed of what he'd done that he threw his life away at the Greenblood rather than live to face dishonor? Someone told. When her father came to see her, she would learn which one. Prince Doran did not come the next day, though, nor the day after. The princess was left alone to pace and weep and nurse her wounds. During the daylight hours she would try to read, but the books they had given her were deadly dull, ponderous old histories and geographies, annotated maps, a dry-as-dust study of the Laws of Dawn, the Seven-Pointed Star and Lives of the High Septons, a huge tome about dragons that somehow made them about as interesting as newts. Ariane would have given much and more for a copy of 10,000 Ships or The Loves of Queen Nymeria, anything to occupy her thoughts and let her escape her tower for an hour or two, but such amusements were denied her. From her window seat, she had only to glance out to see the great dome of gold and colored glass below her, where her father sat in state. "He will summon me soon," she told herself. No visitors were permitted her beyond the servants. Bors, with his stubbly jaw, tall Timoth, dripping dignity, the sisters Morra and Malay, pretty little Cedra, old Balandra, who had been her mother's bedmaid. They brought her meals, changed her bed, and emptied the chamber pot beneath her privy, but none would speak with her. When she required more wine, Timoth would fetch it. If she desired some favorite food, figs or olives or peppers stuffed with cheese, she need only tell Balandra, and it would appear. Morra and Malay took away her dirty clothes and returned them clean and fresh. Every second day a bath was brought for her, and shy little Cedra would soap her back and help her brush her hair. Yet none of them had a word for her, nor would they deign to tell her what was happening in the world outside her sandstone cage. "Has Darkstar been captured?" she asked Bors one day. "Are they still hunting for him?" The man only turned his back on her and walked away. "Have you gone deaf?" Ariane snapped at him. "Come back here and answer me. I command it." Her only reply was the sound of a door closing. "Timoth," she tried another day, "what has become of Princess Myrcella? I never meant for harm to come to her." The last she had seen of the other princess had been on their ride back to Sunspear. Too weak to sit a horse, Myrcella had travelled in a litter, her head bound up in silken bandages where Darkstar slashed at her, her green eyes bright with fever. "Tell me that she has not died, I beg you. What harm could come of my knowing that? Tell me how she fares." Timoth would not. "Balandra," Ariane said a few days later, "if you ever loved my lady mother, take pity on her poor daughter and tell me when my father means to come and see me. Please, please." But Balandra had lost her tongue as well. "Is this my father's notion of torment? Not hot irons or the rack, but simple silence?" That was so very like Doran Martell that Ariane had to laugh. "He thinks he is being subtle when he is only being feeble." She resolved to enjoy the quiet, to use the time to heal and fortify herself for what must come. It was no good dwelling endlessly on Sir Aris, she knew. Instead, she made herself think about the Sand Snakes, Tyene especially. Ariane loved all her bastard cousins, from prickly, hot-tempered Obara to little Loriza, the youngest, only 6 years old. Tyene had always been the one she loved the most, though, the sweet sister that she never had. The princess had never been close to her brothers, Quentin was off at Ironwood, and Tristan was too young. No, it had always been her and Tyene with Garin and Dre and Spotted Silver. Nim would sometimes join them in their sport, and Sorella was forever pushing in where she didn't belong, but for the most part they had been a company of five. They splashed in the pools and fountains of the water gardens and rode into battle perched on one another's naked backs. She and Tyene had learned to read together, learned to ride together, learned to dance together. When they were 10, Ariane had stolen a flagon of wine and the two of them had gotten drunk together. They shared meals and beds and jewelry. They would have shared their first man as well, but Dre got too excited and spurted all over Tyene's fingers the moment she drew him from his britches. Her hands are dangerous. The memory made her smile. The more she thought about her cousins, the more the princess missed them. For all I know, they might be right below me. That night, Ariane tried pounding on the floor with the heel of her sandal. When no one answered, she leaned out a window and peered down. She could see other windows below, smaller than her own, some no more than arrow loops. "Tyene!" she called. "Tyene, are you there? Obara, Nim, can you hear me? Elaria, anyone? Tyene!" The princess spent half the night hanging out the window, calling till her throat was raw, but no answering shouts came back to her. That frightened her more than she could say. If the sand snakes were imprisoned in the spear tower, they surely would have heard her shouting. Why didn't they answer? "If father has done them harm, I will never forgive him, never," she told herself. By the time a fortnight had passed, her patience had worn paper thin. "I will speak with my father now," she told Bors in her most commanding voice. "You will take me to him." He did not take her to him. "I am ready to see the prince," she told Timoth, but he turned away as if he had not heard. The next morning, Ariane was waiting beside the door when it opened. She bolted past Balandra, sending a platter of spiced eggs to crash against the wall, but the guards caught her before she'd gone 3 yards. She knew them, too, but they were deaf to her entreaties. They dragged her back to her cell, kicking and squirming. Ariane decided that she must needs be more subtle. Cedra was her best hope. The girl was young, naive, and gullible. Garin had boasted of bedding her once, the princess recalled. The next time she bathed, as Cedra soaped her shoulders, she began to talk of everything and nothing. "I know you have been commanded not to speak to me," she said, "but no one told me not to speak to you." She spoke about the heat of the day and what she'd had last night for supper and how slow and stiff poor Balandra was becoming. Prince Oberyn had armed each of his daughters, so they need never be defenseless, but Ariane Martell had no weapon but her guile, and so she smiled and charmed and asked nothing in return of Cedra, neither word nor nod. The next day at supper, she nattered at the girl again as she was serving. This time she contrived to mention Garin. Cedra glanced up shyly at his name and almost spilled the wine that she was pouring. "So it is that way, is it?" thought Ariane. During her next bath, she spoke of her imprisoned friends, especially Garin. "He's the one I fear for most," she confided to the serving girl. "The orphans are free spirits. They live to wander. Garin needs sunshine and fresh air. If they lock him away in some dank stone cell, how will he survive? He will not last a year at Gaston Grey." Cedra did not reply, but her face was pale when Ariane rose from the water, and she was squeezing the sponge so tightly that soap was dripping on the mirrorish carpet. Even so, it was 4 more days and 2 more baths before the girl was hers. "Please," Cedra finally whispered, after Ariane had painted a vivid picture of Garin throwing himself from the window of his cell to taste freedom one last time before he died. "You have to help him. Please don't let him die." "I can do little and less so long as I am locked up here," she whispered back. "My father will not see me. You are the only one who can save Garin. Do you love him?" "Yes," Cedra whispered, blushing. "But how can I help?" "You can smuggle out a letter for me," said the princess. "Will you do that? Will you take the risk for Garin?" Cedra's eyes got big. She nodded. "I have a raven," Ariane thought triumphantly, "but who to send her to?" The only one of her conspirators to escape her father's net was Darkstar, By now Sir Gerald might well have been taken, however. If not, he would surely have fled Dawn. Her next thought was of Garin's mother and the orphans of the Greenblood. No, not them. It must be someone with real power, someone who had no part in our plot yet might have reason to be sympathetic to us. She considered appealing to her own mother, but Lady Melario was far away in Norvos. Besides, Prince Doran had not listened to his lady wife for many years. Not her, either. I need a lord, one great enough to cow my father into releasing me. The most powerful of the Dornish lords was Anders Irrenwood, the Blood Royal, Lord of Irrenwood and Warden of the Stone Way. But Arianne knew better than to look for help from the man who had fostered her brother, Quentin. No, Dre's brother, Sir Desiel Dalt, had once aspired to marry her, but he was much too dutiful to go against his prince. Besides, whilst the Knight of Lemonwood might intimidate a petty lord, he did not have the strength to sway the Prince of Dawn. No. The same was true of Spotted Silver's father. No. Arianne finally decided that she had but two real hopes: Harman Ulla, Lord of Hellholt, and Franklin Fowler, Lord of Skyreach and Warden of the Prince's Pass. Half of the Ullas are half mad, the saying went, and the other half are worse. Ellaria Sand was Lord Harman's natural daughter. She and her little ones had been locked away with the rest of the Sand Snakes. That would have made Lord Harman wroth, and the Ullas were dangerous when wroth. Too dangerous, perhaps. The princess did not want to put any more lives in danger. Lord Fowler might be a safer choice. The Old Hawk, he was called. He had never gotten on with Anders Irrenwood. There was bad blood between their houses going back 1,000 years, from when the Fowlers had chosen Martell over Irrenwood during Nymeria's war. The Fowler twins were famous friends of Lady Nym as well, but how much weight would that carry with the Old Hawk? For days Arianne wavered as she composed her secret letter. "Give the man who brings this to you 100 silver stags, she began. That should ensure that the message was delivered. She wrote where she was and pleaded for rescue. Whoever shall deliver me from this cell, he shall not be forgotten when I wed. That should bring the heroes running. Unless Prince Doran had attainted her, she remained the lawful heir to Sunspear. The man who married her would one day rule Dawn by her side. Arianne could only pray that her rescuer would prove younger than the greybeards her father had offered her over the years. I want a consort with teeth, she had told him when she refused the last. She dare not ask for parchment, for fear of rousing the suspicions of her captors, so she wrote the letter on the bottom of a page torn from the 7-pointed star and pressed it into Sidra's hand on her next bath day. There's a place beside the threefold gate where the caravans take on supplies before crossing the deep sand, Arianne told her. Find some traveller headed for the Prince's Pass and promise him 100 silver stags if he will put this in Lord Fowler's hand. I will. Sidra hid the message in her bodice. I'll find someone before the sun goes down, Princess. Good, she said. Tell me how it went on the morrow. The girl did not return upon the morrow, however, nor on the day that followed. When it was time for Arianne to bathe, it was Mora and Malay who filled her tub and stayed to wash her back and brush her hair. "Has Sidra taken ill?" the princess asked them, but neither would reply. "She has been caught," was all that she could think. What else could it be? That night she hardly slept for fear of what might come next. When Timoth brought her breakfast the next morning, Arianne asked to see Ricasso rather than her father. Plainly she could not compel Prince Doran to attend her, but surely a mere Seneschal would not ignore a summons from the rightful heir to Sunspear. He did, though. "Did you tell Ricasso what I said?" she demanded the next time she saw Timoth. "Did you tell him I had need of him?" When the man refused to answer her, Arianne seized a flagon of red wine and upended it over his head. The serving man retreated dripping, his face a mask of wounded dignity. "My father means to leave me here to rot," the princess decided, "or else he is making plans to marry me off to some disgusting old fool and intends to keep me locked away until the bedding." Arianne Martell had grown up expecting that one day she would wed some great lord of her father's choosing. That was what princesses were for, she had been taught, though admittedly her uncle, Oberyn, had taken a different view of matters. "If you would wed, wed," the Red Viper had told his own daughters. "If not, take your pleasure where you find it. There's little enough of it in this world. Choose well, though. If you saddle yourself with a fool or a brute, don't look to me to rid you of him. I gave you the tools to do that for yourself." The freedom that Prince Oberyn allowed his bastard daughters had never been shared by Prince Doran's lawful heir. Ariane must wed. She had accepted that. Dre had wanted her, she knew. So had his brother Desil, the Knight of Lemonwood. Daemon Sand had gone so far as to ask for her hand. Daemon was bastard-born, however, and Prince Doran did not mean for her to wed a Dornishman. Ariane had accepted that as well. One year King Robert's brother came to visit, and she did her best to seduce him, but she was half a girl, and Lord Renly seemed more bemused than inflamed by her overtures. Later, when Hoster Tully asked her to come to Riverrun and meet his heir, she lit candles to the maid in thanks, but Prince Doran had declined the invitation. The princess might even have considered Willis Tyrell, crippled leg and all, but her father refused to send her to Highgarden to meet him. She tried to go, despite him, with Tyene's help, but Prince Oberyn caught them at Vaith and brought them back. That same year, Prince Doran tried to betroth her to Ben Beesbury, a minor lordling who was 80 if he was a day and as blind as he was toothless. Beesbury died a few years later. That gave her some small comfort in her present pass. She could not be forced to marry him if he was dead. And the Lord of the Crossing had wed again, so she was safe from him as well. Eldon Estamont is still alive and unwed, though. Lord Rosby and Lord Grandison as well. Grandison was called the Greybeard, but by the time she'd met him, his beard had gone snow white. At the welcoming feast, he had gone to sleep between the fish course and the meat. Dre called that apt, since his sigil was a sleeping lion. Garin challenged her to see if she could tie a knot in his beard without waking him, but Ariane refrained. Grandison had seemed a pleasant fellow, less querulous than Estamont, and more robust than Rosby. She would never marry him, however, not even if Hotar stands behind me with his axe. No one came to marry her the next day, nor the day after, nor did Sidra return. Ariane tried to win Morra and Melee the same way, but it was no good. If she had been able to get either one alone, she might have some hope, but together the sisters would a wall. By that time, the princess would have welcomed a touch of a hot iron or an evening on the rack. The loneliness was like to drive her mad. I deserve a headsman's axe for what I did, but he will not even give me that. He would sooner shut me away and forget I ever lived. She wondered if Maester Calliot was drawing a proclamation to name her brother Quentin heir to Dorne. Days came and went, one after the other, so many that Ariane lost count of how long she had been imprisoned. She found herself spending more and more time abed, until she reached the point where she did not rise at all, except to use her privy. The meals the servants brought grew cold, untouched. Ariane slept and woke and slept again, and still felt too weary to rise. She prayed to the mother for mercy and to the warrior for courage, then slept some more. Fresh meals replaced the old ones, but she did not eat them either. Once, when she felt especially strong, she carried all the food to the window and flung it out into the yard, so it would not tempt her. The effort exhausted her, so afterward she crawled back into bed and slept for half a day. Then came a day when a rough hand woke her, shaking her by the shoulder. "Little princess," said a voice she'd known from childhood, "up and dress. The prince has called for you." Ario Hotar stood over her old friend and protector. He was talking to her. Ariane smiled sleepily. It was good to see that seamed, scarred face and hear his gruff, deep voice and thick Novoshi accent. "What did you do with Sidra?" "The prince sent her to the water gardens," Hotar said. "He will tell you. First you must wash and eat. She must look a wretched creature." Ariane crawled from the bed, weak as a kitten. "Have Morra and Melee prepare a bath," she told him. "And tell Timoth to bring me up some food. Nothing heavy, some cold broth and a bit of bread and fruit." "Aye," said Hota. Never had she heard a sweeter sound. The captain waited without whilst the princess bathed and brushed her hair and ate sparingly of the cheese and fruit they'd brought her. She drank a little wine to settle her stomach. I am frightened, she realized. For the first time in my life, I am frightened of my father. That made her laugh until the wine came out her nose. When it was time to dress, she chose a simple gown of ivory linen with vines and purple grapes embroidered around the sleeves and bodice. She wore no jewels. I must be chaste and humble and contrite. I must throw myself at his feet and beg forgiveness, or I may never hear another human voice again. By the time she was ready, dusk had fallen. Ariane had thought that Hota would escort her to the Tower of the Sun to hear her father's judgment. Instead, he delivered her to the Princess Solar, where they found Doran Martell seated beyond a Sivas table, his gouty legs supported by a cushioned footstool. He was toying with an onyx elephant, turning it in his reddened, swollen hands. The prince looked worse than she had ever seen him. His face was pale and puffy, his joints so inflamed that it hurt her just to look at them. Seeing him this way made Ariane's heart go out to him, yet somehow she could not bring herself to kneel and beg as she had planned. "Father," she said instead. When he raised his head to look at her, his dark eyes were clouded with pain. "Is that the gout?" Ariane wondered. "Or is it me?"
"Strange and subtle folk, the Volantines," he muttered as he put the elephant aside. "I saw Volantis once on my way to Norvos, where I first met Melario. The bells were ringing and the bears danced down the steps. Ario will recall the day."
"I remember," echoed Ario Hota in his deep voice. "The bears danced and the bells rang and the prince wore red and gold and orange. My lady asked me who it was who shone so bright." Prince Doran smiled wanly.
"Leave us, captain."
Hota stamped the butt of his long axe on the floor, turned on his heel and took his leave.
"I told them to place a Sivas table in your chambers," her father said, when the two of them were alone. "Who was I supposed to play with? Why is he talking about a game? Has the gout robbed him of his wits?" "Yourself. Sometimes it is best to study a game before you attempt to play it. How well do you know the game, Ariane?"
"Well enough to play, but not to win. My brother loved the fight for its own sake, but I only play such games as I can win. Sivas is not for me." He studied her face for a long moment before he said,
"Why?
Tell me that, Ariane. Tell me why." "For the honor of our house." Her father's voice made her angry. He sounded so sad, so exhausted, so weak. "You are a prince," she wanted to shout. "You should be raging. Your meekness shames all Dawn, father. Your brother went to King's Landing in your place, and they killed him." "Do you think I do not know that? Oberyn is with me every time I close my eyes, telling you to open them, no doubt." She seated herself across the Sivas table from her father. "I did not give you leave to sit." "Then call Hota back and whip me for my insolence. You are the Prince of Dawn. You can do that." She touched one of the Sivas pieces, the heavy horse. "Have you caught Sir Geralt?" He shook his head. "Would that we had. You were a fool to make him part of this. Darkstar is the most dangerous man in Dawn. You and he have done us all great harm." Ariane was almost afraid to ask, "Myrcella, is she dead?"
"No,
though Darkstar did his best. All eyes were on your white knight, so no one seems quite certain just what happened. But it would appear that her horse shied away from his at the last instant, else he would have taken off the top of the girl's skull. As it is, the slash opened her cheek down to the bone and sliced off her right ear. Maester Caliot was able to save her life, but no poultice nor potion will ever restore her face. She was my ward, Ariane, betrothed to your own brother and under my protection. You have dishonored all of us. I never meant her harm. Ariane insisted. If Hotar had not interfered, you would have crowned Myrcella queen to raise a rebellion against her brother. Instead of an ear, she would have lost her life. Only if we lost. If. The word is when. Dawn is the least populous of the Seven Kingdoms. It pleased the young dragon to make all our armies